welcome to the Astra Economic Week in Review. My name is John Eckstein. I'm the Chief Investment Officer of Astra Investment Management. I'm joined today by my friend and colleague, Nick Porter. Nick, hello.
Hey, John.
Today, we thought we would bring you a special episode of the Astra Economic Week in Review focused on what's on everybody's mind, which is, of course, inflation. So we'll go over a little bit of the numbers everyone's familiar with, but plan is to talk a little bit about some of the causes of the current inflation, how widespread it is around the world, and possible solutions for it, as well as some of the recent academic thinking, which has come to light recently. So that's the agenda for today. So Nick, inflation, high or low?
It is high, and it is increasingly looking less and less transitory. And
both of us were on team transitory a few months ago. And transitory, we could still be on transitory if we extend the definition of transitory out to a few years, I think.
Right. I mean, that's sort of the debate, is what classifies as transitory. No one was particularly surprised. And in fact, I think a lot of people said that we would be seeing high inflation as we were coming out of the pandemic. So I don't think we were surprised by the numbers. But as you've alluded to, we were really expecting these sort of pressures that we've seen in the economy to go away after maybe, I don't know, 6 months, a year or something like that, depending on your definition of transitory. And we haven't really seen that. It's proven to be quite persistent.
We definitely haven't, right? So the latest numbers for core CPI is up 4% year on year. That is a lot. That's definitely the high end of the last 20 or 30 years. Headline CPI 5.4, which is again high. You know, just to clarify, like the reason people want to use the core is not because people don't buy gas or eat, right? Of course we do. But in general, you find a stronger relationship between the core CPI and next month's CPI than you do the headline to the headline. So it just makes it easier to understand.
Right. And just to add on to that, earlier in the year, we could sort of look past these numbers by saying that there's a base effect. We've compared them to quite low numbers from a year prior, and that's not really the case. We don't get to use that excuse anymore about why inflation is high but not worrying. So, John, what are the other excuses that we can use to wave this away?
Well, let me just rattle through a few of the other numbers first. So core PCE, sure, which is what the Fed looks at, right? So the Fed has roughly a 2% target for core PCE, which is usually half a point or so lower than CPI, mainly because of the ways that they handle rents and stuff. So core PCE is 3.6, well above the Fed's target, but the Fed has moved to an inflation targeting framework, or a quasi-average inflation targeting framework. But basically the end result is that they kind of want the level of the CPE, PCE index to get back towards where it would have been if it had been growing at what they expected all along. So the idea is that they don't have to panic. If you get 1 month above target, you want to get the level back to where it was. Is that your understanding of their new framework?
Yeah, I mean, I think a good way of looking at it is that we've overshot. Perhaps it's okay as long as we're somewhere within that range of what the trend level would have been. And the same is true of disinflation or deflation. Do you know where we are relative to that hypothetical line, John?
Yeah, we are somewhat above where we would be if you extend a trend line back from, say, 2012 to the end of 2019. You extend that trend line out. We're maybe 2 or 3% above where we would be just extending that trend line. And of course, absolute declines in that level are quite low.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty rare that we would see outright deflation in the United States. But, you know, the Fed has been pursuing this policy really with an eye on the last two decades of experience with sort of these secular disinflationary trends that we've seen. You can point out inequality or demographics, whatever the case may be, and saying that we don't really need to be worried about these periods. And of course, this period of inflation has really come at the worst possible time for the Fed, where they've shifted over this new framework, really with the expectation that getting inflation to trend is going to be problematic. And really, as they've seen the reverse all of a sudden, and then that's coupled with a labor market that's not quite at full employment. So they're faced with a dilemma of what to do over the next few months here.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one, I might challenge your characteristic of the labor market. And two, but you're absolutely right that they've been looking at the last 20 years, and the Fed's inflation, actual realized inflation, has been below the target But I think that could also just be like, oh gosh, it's not a target. It's actually an upper bound, which is different.
So I think the other thing that bears mentioning on the topic of the recent CPI print is that we used to be talking about inflation coming from these quote unquote reopening categories. So things like used cars, airlines, hotels. We don't really see that anymore. In fact, some of those are outright deflationary. And where we are seeing price pressures pick up are in things like housing, which is a pretty large component of CPI and tends to be quite a bit stickier, meaning that it's more persistent. And this is sort of another reason to think that the transitory narrative is a little bit underwater, because the so-called transitory pieces of CPI aren't really contributing as much, and the more persistent ones are coming to the forefront.
That's a good point. Like, it is reaching out. So the way that the Bureau of Labor Statistics handles rents is a little bit odd in the CPI series. They do what they call owner equivalence rents, which is like, if you own a house, then part of what you're doing is consuming the housing instead of renting, and what would you have to pay for that? And that's where it comes in. We definitely do see it becoming less of a, just a one, you know, the reopening sectors, though you still do see some of those being big contributors, right? So like used cars, new cars, which it's hard to find a car, right? So inventories are quite low across the board, but they're basically they do surveys of auto dealers and ask them how comfortable you are with your level of inventories. And they say zero, like 0% are comfortable with their level of inventories, or it's usually 80% or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to find a car, and used car prices, I think, are up 20 or 30% year on year at this point. And so there is a lot of those reopening sectors, which are still, and that is supply constrained, right?
Right. Those are certainly supply constrained. I mean, cars, obviously the story there is semiconductors. But again, as we look forward a little bit, I think there is reason to think that we're going to see a broadening away from that kind of stuff into components that might worry a central bank a little bit more.
Yeah. And so right now, the futures market is seeing two hikes in calendar 2022. Like, do you agree with that?
I think it's definitely on the table.
I guess you have to say it's on the table, because they're going to be done with their tapering in June. So they wait a decent interval, 3 or 4 months, and they could raise rates twice in the last quarter of 2022. That's possible. One thing I want to mention before we go into sources and stuff, because it's relevant, is that the U.S. is not alone, right? Like, everybody is seeing, every developed country is seeing inflation in the top decile of their last 20 years history. Germany, Canada, UK, Japan, all of which have had very different policies and experiences in the pandemic, are all seeing inflation very high. So Biden's going to get the blame no matter what. Like, that's what happens in the big chair. But this is not a US-centric phenomenon, right?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, that this is not something that's idiosyncratically broken in the United States. It's really widespread, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. The only thing is that you could certainly point the finger at developed market central banks, which have almost uniformly followed a pretty loose or dovish monetary policy over the past 10 years, certainly since the Great Recession or Great Financial.
Well, I don't think you say that about the ECB, though, right? Like, and their inflation is higher than it's been in 20 years, too.
I mean, I think the ECB has been quite dovish, right?
Oh, they've been dovish. Oh, you're saying that they've been dovish for the last few years since the pandemic. Maybe they have been, but there hasn't been as much. I don't know what the exact amount of fiscal and monetary stimulus like works out to be in all those countries. So like, one of the things that's interesting is, one thing we hear about a lot is the Port of Los Angeles. So the Port of Los Angeles is where, I don't know, like 40% of US containers come through, which is a lot, Los Angeles and Long Beach. So as of a couple of days ago, there were an unprecedented 100 cargo ships waiting to enter the ports. And so, you know, it's a very complicated system. Like, so what happened is that, one, like, people were buying more stuff and fewer experiences, right? So we got a shift of stuff over from China. So then the port gets busy. What happens is that it takes the truck drivers a long time to get their load, and truck drivers aren't paid while they're waiting. So, you know, if you go from waiting an average of 1 hour to an average of 3 hours to get your container, and there's this nationwide shortage of truck drivers, like, you're going to go someplace else. And that only makes the problem worse, right? So then there's fewer places to put the containers because of the physical space in the port is crowded. right? You don't have any place to put containers. And then that makes it longer to unload each ship that comes in, right? So you can only work two cranes instead of six. And that in turn makes the line longer and, you know, also makes it again longer for the truckers to wait. And so it's a big, complicated problem.
Yeah, I think as you've highlighted, the positive feedback loop aspect of this, particularly around shipping, is worrying.
Yeah, so I mean, this is probably the peak shipping time, right? So we'll have some natural seasonal relief. But like right now, supposedly there's 500,000 20-foot equivalent units waiting offshore Los Angeles, which is 10% more than they imported in the entire month of September. Mm-hmm. So there's just a lot of people waiting. And the result is, and this is really, I see, this is really mainly from demand-oriented, or well, this is supply side, demand side, like it's hard to say, but like people definitely want to buy more stuff than they did 2 years ago, and we're not ready to move all that stuff in. And so, and this sort of brings me to my point about if you were on the Fed, what would you do? Like, would you raise rates right now? Like, I think I would say no. The issue is that raising rates isn't going to cut without causing a recession, driving a lot of people out of work. Raising rates isn't going to cut demand meaningfully.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a conundrum for them, but if the problem is really supply, like, you know, factories shut down during COVID, partly because they couldn't get workers and partly because that's sort of the standard recession playbook, and they're just coming back online now and starting to invest more capacity. And the same is true for shipping. Raising rates doesn't really solve that issue. Maybe you get a little bit of demand destruction, but is that really a healthy equilibrium that you're shooting for?
Right, right. Wouldn't it be great if we had unemployment at 10% and had high inflation? Like, no one's saying that. Right. It's also worth pointing out that U.S. manufacturing production is substantially below where it was a couple of years ago. And capacity utilization is substantially below where it was a couple of years ago. Those numbers have turned south recently. And I think the thinking is that that is another reflection of supply constraints, right? Like, you can't buy the intermediate goods, so you can't run your factories full out. But we can peak at capacity, manufacturing capacity utilization at 80, and it's 75 right now. And we are, what, 4 or 5% below the level of manufacturing production that we were at the end of 2018.
Right.
So it's really a shipping issue as far as I can see.
How do you see this all resolving? I mean, my expectation 6 months ago is that we're sort of going to work through this pretty quickly, and that, as you say, the cure for higher prices is higher prices. And so that people are going to start playing catch up a little bit, and these back orders are going to be filled, and capacity is going to be built. And we're going to work through this pretty quickly because that's what global supply chains do. Is that still your view, or do you see this being a little bit more persistent?
So I guess I would have expected to see a little bit more demand destruction at this point, just because of high prices. And so that could be a function of people being flush, right? Aggregate savings is much higher than what you would expect. People have money, and the people who are employed are getting a lower end of the people with high propensity to spend, the lower end of the workforce are getting raises. And so they're still flush. So I guess I don't see it. I see it working out ultimately as like we ration stuff by price for a while. And eventually we move a bunch of shipping containers from Los Angeles to Port of Virginia, which is wide open, and like you're good. But that's going to take a while, right? Because you don't have the drivers and warehouses and all that stuff in place, right? And also the thing is, like, if we just need to import 20% more containers than we did in 2019, we can do that if we get enough lead time, and that will work itself out. I really do think that there is such a strong seasonal component in the shipping that I think it's going to be relieved somewhat sort of Christmas time, right? Another issue at the ports is sending the empty containers back. We're not shipping enough over to Asia to have empty containers ready. And so that's one of the reasons the prices are so expensive too. And, you know, if you are a cookie manufacturer and you want to buy your flour from China, you say, okay, I'll ship some empty containers over. Well, the shipping company isn't going to guarantee, like, those aren't your containers, right? Like, they don't let you, like, okay, I'll even pay for an empty container to go back the other way so I can fill it up and bring it back. And no, it doesn't work like that, right?
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think the supply constraint thing is certainly a big one. I also do wonder how much of this is the U.S. consumer being more flush than they have been over here, as you've talked about. Consumer balance sheets, which are quite healthy, particularly as a result of fiscal support. And perhaps the way that this all ends is, unfortunately, the U.S. consumer going back to a state that they've been at in years prior, where they don't have all these savings, they can't spend all this money on goods, and you start to see more negative real wage losses.
That's certainly possible, right? And that wouldn't surprise me for this country to try and take it out, round things out on the backs of the lowest quartile of consumers and people. But at the same time, you know, again, this is a multi-country phenomenon. And I guess we should know whether like savings are so high in Germany compared to where they usually are. But yeah, I mean, just saying that it's the open-handed US government which is causing this, maybe a little bit, but like that doesn't explain the whole story, right?
Sure.
And I think we will leave it there. If you want more economic data or analysis, you can check the Aster website, AsterIM, that's AsterInvestmentManagement.com. You can download the Aster Research app from your favorite app store, or you can reach out to your Aster representative. Thanks, Nick.
Thanks, John.
To learn more about Aster Investment Management's research and strategies, please visit us on the web at www.asterim.com or stay up to date by following us on LinkedIn, Twitter, and our app is also available on the App Store and Google Play. Thank you. Aster Investment Management, LLC, is a SEC-registered investment advisor. All information contained herein is for informational purposes only. This is not a solicitation to offer investment advice or services in any state where to do so would be unlawful. Analysis and research are provided for informational purposes only, not for trading or investing purposes. All opinions expressed are as of the date of publication and subject to change. They are not intended as investment recommendations.